And time for another DriveFysics.com video presentation. Debate physics also. So anyway, back to Professor Lewin, part two. We should be getting to the nitty-gritty of the two-slit now that we've done the pre-argument, which is about whether this is a battle between different points of view or perspectives, you know, classical versus some sort of new modern. And really, the argument is between, in my opinion, real and completely fake. So, yeah, do we have a real explanation, or are we just going to go with abstract, magical explanations?
But classically, with a bit of randomness. The bit of randomness that we can imagine is that when the photon goes through here, a little random kick might influence the photon and either kick it upwards or downwards.
All right, so the first problem is the idea of what a photon is. So I'll illustrate some of this. I don't really remake videos that I've already made hundreds of times. But, you know, they're trying to contrast different solutions to a question. And, you know, the question becomes, so what is a photon? What do we know about a photon? Well, we know it travels really fast. It's going the speed of light. Then we can say, well, we also know it has a thing called polarization. And the polarization is essentially proportional to whatever you want to consider the wavelength. That is, this height, if we were to say it had a height and that was the polarization, is proportional to this length between the peak and the crest, you would say, or the crest and the crest. So those two are proportional. And so that gets you into some trouble just because the wavelength is the same. The wavelength of light, visible light, is thousands of atoms. So if you took a full wave, you know, from peak to peak, you could fit 1,000 atoms in that distance. So, you know, these are just facts that you have to accept first to be able to get to the next step, which is to say, well, how are you going to describe a photon? Are you going to describe it as a wave with, you know, this really, you know, monstrous, you know, this part's really tiny, but the distance it travels across is really huge. You could say the photon is some object that's moving, you know, I don't know. So I can't do wave for you because wave never made any sense to me. So, but the argument is that if he's going to draw, you know, a circumstance, so here you have an opening, and we're going to argue that now he's going to say the word kick, and, you know, he's going to do it in some way like every single photon is getting kicked. So no matter where it travels, it doesn't go through the middle, it gets kicked. Goes through over here, it gets kicked. No matter where it goes, the same thing happens to it. And the logical argument that can be made is, well, why wouldn't you think that some of the photons just go straight through, and they don't even know they're going through a slit. They have no idea. And the other part of this is built into the argument is this assumption that this distance is some infinitesimally small distance. You know, that this distance is just a few hundred atoms, you know, between the two surfaces, when you think logically there's all kinds of slits that can be millions of atoms of distance. So why am I presuming such a narrow slit? And part of that is so they can describe what the experiment produces in some kind of simple manner, as if there's only one outcome, when of course the outcome can be a blob like that, or the outcome can be lots of blobs. And so it's just taking away options that would, in my opinion, make it clear that this could be about a lot of different things. So again, going back to the description of the photon, if I just make it a blob, then I've lost the idea of frequency. So the idea is to understand that if you want to keep frequency and with a particle model, you have to make it duplicate the wave model. In the sense, nobody draws one wave and says, that's a photon. Nobody draws this and says, photon. No, they always draw, you know, more than one to illustrate. Because really it takes more than one to illustrate. The fact is that I think it's just kind of deducible as a truth that the photon is made of elements, and that those elements are hitting a surface in a manner, okay, bang, 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 that creates an electrical effect that we measure as an electron gaining enough velocity to be kicked out of an atom and create electricity. So that's clearly what's happening. So again, these descriptions are just so crude in the sense that he's forcing the photon to be a blob, and then he's forcing every single photon to get kicked by some random kick, no matter how close it is to the surface. So again, just negating any idea that these two surfaces have anything to do with the function, even though their mathematics is clearly just completely surface dependent. I mean, the key variable is the distance between the two surfaces. Clearly, their key geometry is to create this Pythagorean triangle, you know, of sides and angles, side, angle, side. You know, take the angle and figure out the length of the two sides, and you can figure out whether one side is a full wavelength longer than the other side. And when it's a full wavelength on, well, then you're back in phase. Your two waves, even though if they're out of sequence, they both have the humps in the same places. So if you thought about it as being pieces, you're just saying, well, yeah, the slit knocked out these two pieces, but then another photon put those two pieces back. You know, so you can just think of it as breaking and remaking photons just as well. So I'm just saying they don't give particle model any... They don't argue with a real model. They just argue with what they have strawmanned the alternative theory to be. So they've taken it and forced it to be something it's not, something that doesn't include fundamental elements, and just sat there and, you know, cheated it. Just cheated the concept entirely to promote their vision. And so that's why I just say it's so dishonest. In the sense that obviously you can think of millions of ways of describing a photon, creating all kinds of shapes and all kinds of ways of taking elements and arranging them to fit the minimum requirements, which really are speed, okay, which we all just concede, right? None of us has an explanation for why there's a speed of light. It just is. And the other thing, the key ingredient is frequency. And if you give a person an option to create frequencies in different ways, clearly the model can work. A particle model can be just as capable of explaining the phenomenon. So anyway, that context of just saying is key to understanding what he's saying is understanding that he isn't giving the alternative theory any fair consideration.
In fact, by a random amount. What would we expect then? Well, if there was no randomness, then the photons would go straight through and illuminate a single point.
Be completely good. So at least he concedes that point, that, yeah, they'd go straight through because you sent them a long distance, so you know they're already traveling in a straight line, and they just continue to travel a straight line. And so if your slit is, you know, 1/2000th of a millimeter thick, then all you get is 1/2000th of a millimeter line at the other side.
Really deterministic, the photons would always arrive at exactly the same point, if the hole was small enough, and if the beam of photons was narrow enough. But now we can imagine a random kick. What does the random kick do?
So again, we can defeat this all by just saying, okay, well, we know we can shoot a laser beam with, a millimeter of size of the beam, and we could shoot it through a 2-millimeter slit, and we know that the laser beam's not going to have any problem. It's not going to get kicked. You know, it's going to go straight through, and there won't be any issue at all.
Well, it changes the direction of the photon, not the whole photon beam, but one photon at a time. It might kick the first photon up a little bit, the second photon down, and so forth.
So I'm arguing that the kick can just be understood as scatter. That if you assume that the surface of whatever it is you're shining the light past, whatever you're making your surface out of, that surface is a mixture of two mediums, you know, the atmosphere and whatever this stuff is made out of. And on that surface you have atoms and electrons. And those electrons can scatter the light. And so the light that goes near the surface, again, it has a big polarization, thousands of atoms. So you can sort of understand something very big going by a very small surface that half of it could be knocked out, a quarter of it, a tenth of it, a piece of it can clearly be broken. So it's no longer a visible photon, but it's still stuff going through the opening. there's still energy going somewhere.
Forth and so on. Eventually, what you will see is a blob.
All right, so you only get one blob if it's narrower than a wavelength, the slit opening. So if you make it two wavelengths wide, then you get two blobs. And if you make it three, you'll get two. Okay, that's the trick. Because really, two of them are very close to each other, so they'll overlap a little bit. So their edges will overlap. I probably shouldn't have to draw this. I've been over it so many times, but I'll do it just to be sure you're following along correctly. All right, let's see. Do I have a place? Yeah, over here is good enough. I'll just do it up and down, right? maybe up here? Yeah, up here is okay. All right, so you're going to... The real key is that the surfaces are actually causing the kicks. So all the kicks are going to come from the surface, and they're going to come in either direction. So it's just like two little suns are right here on the surfaces, and they're sending little rays of light now, little pieces, to a surface. Now, the distance between them will decide, whether you can have a wavelength of difference. So if this distance is smaller than a wavelength, I can't make any points over here that are going to cause destructive interference, because I can't get a full wavelength out of phase, or a half wavelength. So I just get one blob if it's really narrow. But the real point is that there's really two systems here. There's this system and this system. And this system's going to start here, and this system is going to start here. And it's going to make the fringes this way, and this one's going to make them this way. So the point is the overlap part means that there's, one here, and then there'll be another one going over here. And these two will move in these directions where they can separate by a little bit of distance or separate by no distance. And that's why this center maxima is somewhere between a little less than two and, in terms of its size. And something more than two, if they're separated by a little distance, and the light goes straight through and just fills this in. So the light here is really bright, and it just kind of fills in that whole part, but there's really two nodes here. And that's what's causing the double maxima, is that it's not behaving like waves. It's two separate conditions that are two point sources are separated from each other, and they're going to create a pattern this way and this way. They're what you're matching to. So your L is really separated in space to two different places. You have an L this way and you have an L this way, distance wise. Let's see, is there some other way to say that? Well, I don't think there needs to be. So the point is if it's one wavelength, then I'm going to get one big long blob. That's all I'm going to have. If it's two, then I'll get two, and they'll overlap. All right. So it'll still look like one. If it's three, I'm going to have the same problem. I'm going to get overlap, and the other ones aren't full nodes. They're only half nodes down here. And then if I have four, then I can start to do the two here and then two here. And 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 10. So the more wavelengths I create in terms of distance between this point and this point, the more distance I create between them, the more bars I create, and the smaller the bars get, obviously. And so in describing this, he's just ignoring that feature, that this is the known truth, is that that's what controls. The controlling factor is this distance between two point sources. And that's just kind of obvious. And so why don't any of them say that? Why don't any of them put those two and two together? That this isn't a random pattern. The pattern is precisely controlled by how far away those two point sources are from each other. All right, we can get rid of this and continue.
Of illumination on the screen over here. On the average, the photon might go straight ahead, so the blob might be most intense at the center.
So it might go straight ahead. So why would he even say that? He just said how they're all randomized. It might kick up, might kick down. Why would the ones in the middle tend to go more straight? Why would there be a bias for those photons? So now he's conceding, in a sense, well, maybe the surfaces have something to do with it. The ones that are far away from the surface go straighter, and the ones that are closer to the surface go more crooked. So he's getting closer to the truth.
it might be highly improbable to knock the photon through 60 or 70 degrees.
Might be impossible. They've never tested it. So this is another experiment they never did. They never put photographic film. I think the mouse should show up in the right place here. They never put it here to see how many photons are going at that harsh angle. So we don't have any knowledge of whether there's any likelihood of the steep angles, that any photons ever travel the steep angles. So it might be, yeah, as soon as you get past, say, 30 degrees, no photons. Because what might actually be causing how much they deflect, instead of it being random, it might be actually being caused by how many electrons the photon hits, the little piece, the element of the photon. So one of the little pieces of the photon, each little piece is going a different direction, and there's a 50-50 chance you'll put them back in phase, and those are the bars, those are the fringe pattern. And the fact is, though, if the little piece hits one electron, then hits another electron, then hits another electron, another electron, another electron, it can get more and more angular deflection. But it can only get, say, 10 degrees from one electron, so it has to hit more than one to get 30 or 50 or 60. And so these become really improbable. So the one at 89 degrees, that's a highly improbable.
So the signal would fade as you moved away from the center. You would see a blob with a maximum intensity.
So again, there's no concession to the fact that if the kick was random, it wouldn't fade. You could draw a circle here, equidistant. And if it was a random kick, you should expect just as many photons at 89 degrees as you got at the zero. You should expect just as many if it was a random kick. If it was a random kick, you'd have just as many 60 degrees as you did 90 degrees. And that isn't the truth. So clearly this is more about how many photons actually interact with the surface, and, you know, in interacting with the surface, can they be affected enough to acquire such a dramatic change in their direction.
Sitting near the center and thinning out as you move far away. And you might describe it by a probability function, the probability function being the probability that the photon arrives in different places.
And it's not anything their math creates, it's what they create. They create the probability, they put into the math the permutations. Now earlier he said something that was kind of a mistake, and I didn't take it the opportunity to point it out, but he said, in comparing probability, he said, well, it could be snake eyes. You know, you roll snake eyes on the dice, or it could be a seven, as if those two things were equally probable, when of course they're not anywhere close to the same probability. This is like seven ways to get a seven, and there's only like one way to get snake eyes. So if one was left and the other was right, you'd be going right a lot more than you're going left. So again, he's telling you it's a probability, and yet he knows, well, it's a probability on a scale, you know, and the scale is being defined by some arbitrary statement that they're just going to say it has diminishing returns. It gets weaker by 3% or something. But there's no logic to why it does. Why do the random kicks not do 90 degrees just as often as they do 60 degrees? Why do they do 30 degrees more than they do 60 degrees? If they're random kicks, shouldn't they do 60 just as often as they do 30?
Okay. Now we go, now we do the same thing in real quantum mechanics. In other words, in the real world.
Yeah, so they don't do any of this in anything called a real world. So there is no real world example of any of this. These are all descriptions of invisible worlds.
We see essentially the same thing.
They don't see it.
The photons go through the hole with no ability to control the situation.
So again, the controller seems quite obvious. It's the opening. You make the opening narrower. What are you doing? You're increasing the likelihood that whatever you're putting through the hole is going to interact with the surface of the hole. You make the hole wider, you've made it less likely. So with a hole this big, there's a billion to one chance the photon is anywhere near a surface. Man, with a hole that big, now there's a 500 to one chance that, you know. So I just keep making the hole smaller, I'm increasing the likelihood of interaction with the surface, and that's all I'm doing. So I'm creating more photons that can potentially be deflected out of the total number. Now, obviously, if I'm making the hole smaller, I have less total photons to work with, but I have a higher probability that the ones that do get through had interaction with the surface. So that's the, in my opinion, a clear logical deduction that will never be talked about by any of these talking heads of two-slit phabiology. They'll never say it. They'll never talk about the fact that what's the key thing you're changing when you're changing the size of the hole? You're changing the likelihood that the photon will interact with the surface. That's the obvious thing you're changing.
We find out that the photons again create a blob like this.
So he says, again, create a blob like this in a condition that's no different. So there is no blob like this. There can be lots of blobs. All I do is make the hole bigger, lots of blobs.
But now we're going to do something a little different. And I think everybody here, more or less everybody.
Right. They're not going to do anything substantially different, except they're going to change the distances between the surfaces. So he's going to combine two single slit experiments, but they won't be combined with just this distance. Now they're going to combine, okay, and create a new distance, this distance, and the distance in between. So now the distances will change. That's all it is, though. It's two of these just moved into each other, and instead of the biggest distance being this and this, the biggest distance is obviously now this bigger distance. So in adding them, you have to add the features that you're really adding. This is what you're adding, this big distance here.
He knows what I'm going to do. I'm going to open a second hole. Okay, but let's think about what classical randomness would do.
So again, he's going to think about it as if he hasn't changed the... Again, he's putting two scatter engines next to each other. So he has two sources of scatter, and then he's going to add two more sources of scatter. Two more locations where bits can come from. Obviously, if you labeled them A, B, C, and D, you could understand that the A-D combination is a lot different than the A-B combination. There's a huge number of wavelengths of differences between those two surfaces. And obviously, if you drew a triangle from A to D, being the base of the triangle, it's a very different triangle from the triangle from A to B being the base of the triangle. Huge difference, or A to C even. So that's what you've changed. You've taken two things that are, you know, by themselves, peanut butter and chocolate, and, you know, you've combined them and made something new, in fact. It's not the same thing as the original stuff, in the sense that it's a combination of them. And the combination has a consequence. They don't stay independent. It's not just an AB and then plus another AB. It's an AB and then plus now CD, because you've changed the distances.
Classical randomness would simply mean that, and we'll also imagine that this beam of photons is at its origin a little bit uncertain and a little bit random.
All right, so that's the fakery of when they talk about the electron experiment. It's exactly the opposite. The only way the electron experiment works is to focus the beam at the surface, at the slits. It actually forces the electrons to go through the slits. It aims them right through the slits. So it's, you know, a completely opposite fundamental character. See, their theory breaks down. If I can actually aim photons and shoot them through one slit or the other slit, all of their entanglement theory falls apart, because then I do know where the photon is. I haven't Heisenberged it into some sort of entangled superposition state. I haven't done any of that wooey crap. Okay, and so once we get to the point where we actually have laser beams that are narrow enough, this whole thing will be provably nonsense, because we'll actually be able to shoot the beam right through the slit and we'll know exactly where the photon went, whether it went through the A slit or the B slit. And, you know, we won't be able to play this game of blaming some sort of this photon splits in two and goes through both slits nonsense.
But some photons begin a little bit upward, some photons a little bit downward, some photons go through the upper hole, some photons go through the lower hole.
Right, so there is the randomness is just in that amount. You don't need to spread them any more than to have them moving where some can get to the two slits. But that's it. And frankly, if you create a light source that's already as wide as the slits, that is, the laser beam's already as wide as the slits, so this isn't even an issue. And the further back you shoot the laser beam from, the more assured you are that there is no angle at which it's entering the slits. It's entering it going very straight.
If a photon goes through the upper hole, it may or may not get a random kick and get knocked off course. If it goes through the lower hole, it also gets a random kick. Now we're imagining the photons.
So again, the whole thing breaks down with the word photon, because the whole photon isn't doing any of this stuff. Pieces of the photon are in what I would argue a viable particle theory. It's not one piece of the wave. Again, you don't draw the photon as one little wave and say, there, that's a photon. Nobody does that. So clearly the photon is a sequence of events. And each little sequence is affected by the slit. And now you've essentially created chaos in the shape of the photon. And all you're saying is can I restore out of that chaos photons? And the simple truth is, the only thing you've really broken is their phase. You've only taken them out of phase by sending them to different places. You've changed their phase. The distances don't matter. If I just had little rays hitting, they're all the rays are making it to the surface. And the only question is, are there places where you have some likelihood that the rays are now back in phase? And so that's why phase works. You're just taking the bullets that were all fired at the same time. By moving the bullets different distances, you're changing whether they're going to hit the surface in phase at the same time. And that's all you're doing. And there's a 50-50 chance that any bullet landing is going to be in phase with the original bullet going in the straight line, or out of phase with the original bullet traveling the shortest distance. And that's all you're saying, is it's in phase with those other pieces, or is it out of phase with those other pieces? And if you put it back in phase, it's a visible photon. If you don't put it back in phase, it's not visible.
Come through one at a time. We could even imagine a... Okay. I do that all the time.
Can't hear him. I guess they meant farting. He does that all the time. I don't know.
Where was I? Yes, the photons get a kick. We're imagining that the photons come through one at a time, very sparsely.
Okay, so we're imagining, because there is no gun that can produce that. No way they can simulate single photons or approximate them is to put a bunch of filters in front of the light to try to mask it, a bunch of smoke, essentially. See how much of the light they can diminish. So they have some theoretical notion that the photons are now at this minimum amount. Now, Veritasium tried to do this experiment, and he had to keep changing the speed of the experiment. That is, he tried to do it over 6 hours, and it didn't work. And he tried over 3 hours, and that didn't work. And what he had to do was cut it to 5 minutes to get it to work. And the trick is that what he was doing by cutting the time was basically ensuring that there's a likelihood of more than one photon in the experiment. So if they do it where they really ensure that there's no chance that there could be two photons in the experiment at the same time, it doesn't work. And it only works if they cut that margin. And they do their calculations based on some notion that the photon is a little infinitesimally sized thing, when we're arguing that the photon is thousands of atoms long and thousands of atoms high, in terms of the space it occupies. So, they do their calculations based on the size of the electron, let's say, and then pretend, that the thing is the atom. And obviously that would be crazy, because the electron is a billion times smaller than the atom.
And so what one photon does doesn't influence a later photon.
Right, so this is just the argument that photons aren't made out of anything called ether or stuff that sticks to itself. So it's not a water molecule dragging other molecules with it. Each quanta of the photon is a free agent. One of them can't jiggle and cause another one to jiggle. One of them can't do something that causes something else to do something. All they can do, these little bits, is hit. They have to hit an electron. They can't just fly by an electron and make it wobble or any of that nonsense. So, you know, these are debatable subjects, but I'm just saying if you really look at the facts are that photons don't behave in any way like they're adhered to each other. They behave in every respect like they can do whatever they want independently and the rest of the photons don't move with them. There is no idea that they spread across a field or that they do any of this kind of stuff. And then they have to come up with, because they're glued to that kind of notion, they come up with these silly theories that the photon really traveled in every possible direction, but it only landed in one direction. And somehow it just undid, you know, all of its traveling to all the other places because it never gets to land there. So somehow it just pretends it didn't happen.
Because the later photon comes through so much later that whatever gave the first photon a kick is already finished happening and it's
all right. So this is, again, they're saying they're doing something a certain way, and if you analyze the experiments, they're not doing that. Their assumption is a photon doesn't have any length at all, so they make them infinitesimally small, and that way they can pretend that there's no odds of two being in the experiment at the same time because the amount of shared place would be so tiny. But if you make them 3 inches long, well, now you're all of a sudden in big trouble. Because now overlap is really, see, if I make them really, really thin, there's very little likelihood of overlap. But the longer I make them, the more likely overlap becomes, right? I mean, it almost becomes impossible when you say, here's an inch, you know, a certain amount of distance, and I have two things this long, and they're going to have to overlap. There's no chance they can't overlap. But if I make them shorter and shorter and shorter, yeah, there's lots of places they could be, spaces where they're not overlapping. And so they're using a fake description of what a photon is to make it mathematically possible to say there can't be two photons in the experiment. But they're not being fair to how big a photon has to be logically.
Waiting for the next throw of the dice. In fact, the next photon may come through 100 throws of the dice later. And so we expect the next photon to be random.
All right, so the real point is if they really could make a single quanta of a photon, that is one of the single elements, and they could ensure that no two elements are ever in the experiment at the same time, then it would be impossible to have constructive interference because the two couldn't land in sequence at the same, you know, on the same location. None of this could happen if you take away the fact that there has to be four sources. There has to be four surfaces creating pieces. If the four sources aren't creating pieces at the same time, they certainly can't put something, they can't shoot something in phase. So they need to have stuff. You need to have stuff at all the surfaces or you're not going to create the pattern.
Statistically independent of the first photon, under those circumstances, what we would expect. Well, let's decide what we would expect. Supposing only one hole is open, if only one hole was open, then we would see a...
This is going to be a classical mistake. Feynman makes it. They all make it. So this means they really haven't thought about what you would expect the experiment to produce. Because this is such a classic mistake.
A blob of illumination like that, with a profile that might look something like that. Supposing we closed up the first blob, the first hole, and opened...
So let's know, the hole is 1 millimeter. So they're even less than that. That's how far the holes are from each other. The outside of one hole is only less than 1 millimeter away from the outside of the other hole. So the two holes are just a fraction of a millimeter different in distance.
Second hole. Close the first one, open the second one. So first we begin with just one hole, Then we close the first hole and open the second hole. What would you expect to see? What you would expect to see under those circumstances is a different blob, slightly displaced from the first
hole. Okay, so he said slightly displaced. It would be almost imperceptibly displaced. It wouldn't be slightly displaced. It would be such a small amount on the target. The target's amplifying the pattern. It's making it bigger, okay, by projecting it. So anything that's at an angle is going to be made bigger. But anything going straight isn't going to be made bigger. So anything traveling a straight path doesn't get enlarged. So the difference between the light going straight through is going to be nothing. There's not going to be two different focuses here. There's not going to be two separate patterns projected at two separate locations as if they went out this way. The idea is the two patterns are going out this way, dead straight. And everything that is converging happens within 1 millimeter. You wouldn't be able to see all the angles that are convergent angles, where the two sources push something towards each other. All of those are impossible to see, because they're inside of 1 millimeter.
The blue blob wouldn't be there because we closed the first hole.
When you close two holes that are less than a millimeter apart, you don't see two, like you see the left one and then you see the vision of the right one. The two will look like they were exactly in the same place. They're going to be so close to each other, so close to covering exactly the same space.
The green blob would be there because we opened the second hole. Now, what happens if we open both holes? What happens if you open both holes in classical mechanics?
So we know if these both holes are bigger than a wavelength, there's no lump here, right? So we know if we actually did this experiment with single slits and we just migrated them into each other, they would be a single slit pattern, meaning there could be lots of bars. So there'd be lots of bars and lots of bars merging into each other. Now the thing is that single slit now is going to create, these four sources are now going to mix with each other, and when they mix, they're going to make bars that are much smaller because you've increased the outside surface distance. You've taken a distance maximum that was this big and you've made the distance maximum that big. So you've clearly changed what the sources, the combinations of sources, and that's what makes the change in the pattern. But it's a lie to say you started with two humps, because that won't be what you're starting with if the slits are more than a wavelength open, that is more than 2/1000th of a millimeter. If the slits are any kind of reasonable opening, it won't be just a blob and a blob mixing.
Is the probability for a photon to get to the screen at any given point is the sum of the probabilities for it to get there by either route?
So that doesn't mean anything, because that won't work. Okay, so he's basically saying either route being either opening. And the opening isn't the focus. It's not the point source. So if you use, really should use the drawing board for this part. So I'll be back. All right, should be back. All right, so this is kind of a key point where, you know, if you don't get this, you're not going to get nothing, you know, that matters. In terms of understanding the deception of their argument. Because this goes back to the very origin of the two-slit and the Young drawing of the two-slit. So I've already done this so many times. But the idea is, like he just explained, this is the center of the kick. So when he says there's a random kick, this is it here, right here in the center of the opening. He's saying it scatters this way, evenly out of the opening. Right. And that's essentially the Young drawing, in the sense that Young used waves to illustrate that function, you know, where the wave goes through the opening and gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and the two waves intersect with each other and they create an interference pattern. That wave interference, that two source interference, won't create key feature of the single slit pattern once you make it bigger than a wavelength. When you make it bigger than a wavelength, in this case probably 100 times bigger, because you're going to maybe have 100 nodes. And again, the nodes are traveling on this arc. Okay, that's the distance L. All right, so the nodes are, you're really predicting this, a pattern on this arc. So he has two scatter points. So no mathematics uses these centers, okay, because these centers won't get you the right answer. Because the real sources have always been the surfaces. So in the single slit, experiment, okay, and in the single impediment experiment, you have the same pattern because you have the same d distance. You have the same distance between two surfaces. So you get the same number of nodes because the only distance that matters is how far away are the two sources. These are the sources, the surfaces. And whether it's an impediment or an opening doesn't make any difference. Those are the two sources. The sources are the surfaces. And if you use this analogy of this center, okay, and consider it to be two source, you can't possibly do the double slit experiment, which is going to create a pattern of what will be little blobs, all right, inside of this pattern. So you'd have three here and three here. And these would be three, it's just you're not going to see them as three because it gets, you start getting diminishing returns as you start going further and further. The higher the angle, the less light you're getting. But the idea is that's the pattern you'll see. Okay, that's the double slit pattern. So this is the real pattern, and you can't either explain this double maxima, this 2x thing in the middle, that what he said, scatter from the wave centers, can't create that. And it certainly can't create that plus these little nodes. Okay, two wave theory can't do that. The only way you can do that is have the combination of this distance, okay, the biggest distance between two surfaces, that's making these little tiny ones. That's a lot of wavelengths. Lots of wavelengths fit between these two distances. That's a big triangle with lots of wavelength difference places. So that makes little bars. So you have to have this distance for the little ones, and then you have to have the shortest distance, which might be the slits or it might be the impediment, but it doesn't matter. Whatever the shortest distance is, that's going to make this pattern, the envelope that it's stuck inside of. It's the combination of the two of four sources. So you're adding sources, at least three, right? You have to have at least three sources, but the fact is the sources are going to be in phase, so three is just as likely as four. And that's what you're really saying. Where do this pattern is going to be made out of? Where do all four sources, where are they all in phase? And where are all four, and where are there just two sources? If it's just two sources, you know, these two sources, no photon. If it's four sources, photon. Two sources, no photon. And the spaces between here is when the envelope is off. And the wide ones are in phase. So these two are out of phase. That's the little bar. That's the darks between the little bars. And when the two wide ones are in phase, that's the bright spot. But there's no hope of illustrating or mathematically constructing this pattern with their old single slit math. And the only way they cheat to do it is they get rid of two of the point sources. They either make this thing so close together, they make this a tiny wire, so these two sources are right next to each other, so they're now irrelevant. There's not two sources anymore. If I put two sources really close to each other, they're not two sources anymore. There's no triangle anymore. You've eliminated the capacity to have a difference between A and B. A can never be a wavelength bigger than B if I make this base smaller than a wavelength. The difference between A and B always is going to be dictated by how big the base of that triangle is. I have to make the base of the triangle big if I want to have big differences between A and B. Can't have it unless I make the base big. So I can't have wavelength of difference. So what they do is they either make these two surfaces right next to each other, or they make these two surfaces so close that they eliminate, again, these middle ones because they're the same as these outside ones. So if you make the slits really thin, then you make the impediment surface and the outside surface the same point. And so you have one point there, and then you have one point on the other side. But that's all you're going to have. So all they're doing is reducing four-point sources into two-point sources and recreating the single slit experiment. They're just showing you the envelope pattern, essentially, and saying, there, that's the double slit pattern. When the real double slit pattern is this pattern. Key fact. Single slit math only works to illustrate a double slit experiment if you make the surfaces so close to each other there's not a wavelength of difference. Then you can get this fake pattern, okay, this not double slit pattern, and say, there, my math described it. But as soon as I make this impediment bigger than a wavelength and I make the slit openings bigger than a wavelength, I'm going to get this pattern, and this pattern cannot be described with two-point sources. Two-point sources can't make this pattern. It still can't make this double maxima anyway, but it clearly can't make this more complex pattern on top of it. So it fails in two respects. Wave theory fails catastrophically in two ways. But they'll never concede that argument. You know, it's, you know, undeniable fact. They'll deny it anyway. All right, so, maybe a break. Yeah, all right, continuing and such.
The photon can either go through the upper root, or it can go through the lower root.
So he keeps saying the lower root, the upper root. Again, there's no defining of what a root means. And clearly, I would argue, it's going to be clear that you have to have four-point sources to create the true double slit pattern, which he won't show. He's just going to show, again, just bars and lumps moving across the screen, but he's not going to illustrate the fact that it has to have those two patterns, the envelope and the little pattern inside of it.
If both holes are open. The probability to get to this point over here, let's call it the green point over here, the probability to get over there is the probability to go through the upper hole and arrive at the green point, plus the probability to get to go through the lower hole and arrive at the green point. So the result is, in classical physics, you would always see the signal over here, the profile over here, just being the sum of the two probability distributions.
So, of course, you wouldn't if you included frequency and phase. So if you understood that you're still stuck with in phase or out of phase, and if you're using point sources that are far enough apart, again, centers even, that are far enough apart, you're clearly going to have a lot more pattern than this, and you're going to have in-phase and out-of-phase location. So he's just breaking, he's saying that in conventional physics there's no phase, when obviously we know the photon has a frequency, and we know frequencies can be in-phase and out-of-phase. So it's just a denial of the element of frequency. He's taken frequency out of the conventional view and said there's no such thing as frequency in conventional physics. He's cheated it so horribly here.
And it would look, I wish I had another color. They never leave me enough colors. All right. We would see something which would look like just a higher, I don't know, it would be much bigger than that. It would look like that.
So what you would really see, again, if you're going to use a conventional model and say frequency is irrelevant, and we're just saying how many photons went through the slits are less than a millimeter apart, they're both going to project a line on the screen that's less than a millimeter apart. A very bright line. So they're not going to make this double hump thing, because the two lines aren't. They're going to be two separate lines that go straight to the wall, and so it's not going to make any doubling. Because he didn't draw it right the first time.
And in particular, if there was any point over here such that the photon could arrive either from one hole or from the other hole or both.
All right, so and again, this is his injection of them randomly scattering and without any bar pattern. So again, these are slits that are smaller than a wavelength because they're creating no pattern. So you get it, that this hump would stretch all the way around the 180 degrees. There wouldn't really be an end to the hump here if it was less than a wavelength. If you make it less than a wavelength, the center maxima spreads and spreads and spreads. And there's a point where you just don't have any more photons because you've made the slit so fucking narrow. No photons are getting through it. It's so narrow. And you just wipe it out and you get nothing. You don't even get a hump. So if I really did the experiment with infinitesimally small slits, that is slits smaller than a wavelength, none of the photons are going to get through. And you will not be able to merge your two patterns because the fact is there won't be any photons to merge them out of. Because none of them are going to survive getting through the slits. None of them have a polarization narrow enough to survive getting through the slits and creating any kind of recombining of photons because there's so few photons in the experiment. So he's cheating so badly. But the simple truth is you won't. There's no expectation, if you know anything about the mechanics, that you slide two single slits into each other and they just become one big blob in the center. That's not what it's going to create. Because that's not how it started. That's not how it's already working. And so his premise is nonsense.
Then we would find illumination at that point for sure by opening both holes. That's what classical logic. Let's call it
that. So again, this is just such a straw man. No, this is what, this is just pigeonholing and straw manning the opposing argument by giving it no depth, giving it no capacity to deal with any circumstance, just totally cripple it, totally retard it, and then pretend you defeated it. It's such junk. Even if you were doing devil's advocate work, you should be fairer than this. Even if we were to be a devil's advocate for a moment and imagine particle theories, again, I can imagine better theories, off the top of my head, without even trying to be fair. And you're not even trying to be fair. Clearly.
Right name, classical logic. That's what classical logic, classical statistics, classical probability would dictate.
So there's no dictating it. Again, if you gave the particles frequency, if you made the slits wide enough to actually create to more than one source, which you didn't, you violated every rule of making it mechanically possible just to say, there, I have abolished the particle theory. Now you'll believe anything I tell you. And you won't even set your own theory to the same standards of explaining any of it. Explaining how the photon's moving, what the photon's made out of, how the photon interacts with the surface. You'll just leave out every single detail. And say, just believe the woo because I defeated anything called reason and logic. It's just so unfair.
For a series of particles coming through here, one at a time. When they come through one at a time, they make blip, 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 blip.
So again, they don't do that. There's no blip, 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 blip without making the blips out of bloops. The blip isn't just a blob hitting the screen. It's more than a blob. It's a thing with a frequency. So again, you're just cheating the argument.
Average probability of the distribution of blips would be a distribution which would be the sum of the two distributions.
Well, it wouldn't, because you can't sum to, like I said, if you had real single slit patterns and you merge them, you're not really going to sum them. They're going to merge in the sense that you're now creating new point sources at new differences. So you're going to create bars that are much smaller than the original bars. Because you're increasing the distance of the outside surfaces from each other, you're automatically changing bars that were this big into bars that are this big.
What happens if you really do this experiment? You find what's called an interference pattern. The interference
pattern. So he won't draw it as it is, I predict. He's not going to draw the two slit pattern. He's going to draw the single slit pattern. And pretend he went through all this trouble evading the pattern. And now he's going to draw the real pattern that actually happens when you had the single slit there. The actual pattern is not the blob.
Pattern looks like this. Well, let's see. Let me get it right.
Okay, missing is going to be the double maxima. So we're not going to have a maxima twice the size. So he's going to cheat the element you know, and we're not going to have the little pattern inside the envelope pattern. So he's going to basically eviscerate the major features of the patterns and just pretend they don't happen because he doesn't have an explanation for them.
In particular.
So, I mean, he drew it really poorly. They always, Feynman did the same thing. He doesn't even have the central maxima lined up with the center. You know, it's just really poor. But obviously no double maxima in the center, right? He has it higher, but he doesn't have it doubled this way, which is the real effect. The real effect isn't just that it has a higher amplitude. It spreads a wider distance.
Well, first of all, what is this figure? This figure is a probability distribution, and it tells you...
And it doesn't happen. So let's just understand, it doesn't happen. The pattern never looks like that, ever. Not with a single slit, not with a double slit. No matter what you do, you won't make that pattern.
The horizontal axis here tells you what the probability of a photon getting to a particular point at a particular height here, but in particular, it says that there are no photons which arrive at that point.
So again, the argument would be is that there's nothing in phase at that point. There's plenty of energy hitting that point. So if they could measure the actual energy, the heat even, I think you would find there's no pattern. Just as much heat is hitting that point as the center of where there's light. And all you've done is break the photon in the sense that red photons aren't green photons. You know, I change the frequency a little bit, I'm going to change the photon. So if I break the phase of the frequency, then I'm going to have a photon that you won't see because it won't be red and it won't be green. I can't combine the two frequencies and say I have a red-green photon. There is no red-green photon. So if I break the frequency, I don't have a photon, but I still have something that's going to hit that surface. It just won't be seen as a photon.
There are no photons which arrive at that point. There are no photons which arrive at that point. This is odd. If you opened only one hole, then you would find a probability distribution which wasn't zero. In other words, you would find illumination at that point.
Right, and that's, again, just understanding that you're not really combining two ABs. You're combining AB with CD, and you're creating new distances and, you know, new triangles. You're creating triangles with new bases. So when you combine the two single slit experiments, you have a size of their base of their triangle. Well, now you're changing the size of the bases of their triangle. They're morphing into each other. So yes, they don't just superimpose on top of each other without changing each other.
You open the other hole, you still find illumination at that point. You open both holes, and all of a sudden, no photon gets to that point, even though they're coming through once every 20 minutes or once every...
So again, that doesn't happen. So the idea that they've created the experiment and done the double slit and get this idea, but none of that's happened with single photons because the theory of single photons is flawed by the fact that we can't make single photons. We have no way to generate with any kind of reliability a single photon. And we have no way to mask photons in such a way as that we can guarantee them not being there unless we do actually take the time to make an experiment that creates so few photons. And again, Veritasium already hit that wall and crashed into it. He did the experiment over a long period of time and it didn't work. He wasn't getting any pattern because, yes, there wasn't any photons in the experiment at the same time to interfere with each other. The elements of the photon couldn't be put back in phase because there wasn't any sources. You broke the sources because you don't have photons at both sources at the same time. So, again, it's exaggeration and imprecision to say they can make single photons or they are certain they have made single photons. Because they really haven't. All right, it's probably as good as any point to say this is video two, and then we'll play the ending. I don't know. He's probably going to get into all the quantum crap pretty quickly, so it might not be very fruitful, the last video, but we'll see. But clearly, no description of the double slit pattern. So no explanation for the double maxima, no explanation for the envelope pattern and the pattern inside of that. And clearly no theory talking about how you need more than two sources if you're going to make the complex true double slit pattern. If you're going to make the real double slit pattern, you have to have more point sources. And it's clear, mathematically hard cleared factual, that you can predict the size of the little nodes by just counting how many wavelengths are in the longest distance. It's just a fact. It will absolutely predict how many of those little blobs are going to be in that pattern. And that fact should be hardened in people's heads that, yes, that means these are the sources. The surfaces are the sources. That's why the math identifies the surfaces as the sources. When they use the variable d, they're not using the distance between the centers of the opening. They're using the distance between the surfaces, and especially the surfaces that matter, the surfaces that are bigger than a wavelength apart from each other. So depending on which one they've squished, there's still going to be a surface that's bigger than a wavelength left over, and one that's the longest. And the longest is going to be the little dots, the smallest is going to be the size of the envelope. Just a fact. That works, clearly indicating the surfaces are the function. They're causing the kick. The kick isn't random. The kick isn't fabulistic. The kick isn't angels didn't do it. It's not the Holy Ghost. It's kicking photons. The surfaces covered in electrons is changing the direction of the photons. All right. Facts, I think, more than adequately proven by the relationship between that distance and the size of those little dots.